MacCast, Saturday, April 30th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Got a great show for you today. Apple's finally responded to location gate issues. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Spending some money, quite a bit actually, to shore up their supply chain, make sure that they have plenty of iPads to deliver in the next quarter. Rumors of new iMacs, some Apple updates, and of course your comments and questions. Great stuff to dive into. But before we get to that, I want to take a quick moment, recognize one of our show's sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, it's getting around summertime. A lot of us plan on taking vacations in the summer, and Notebook actually turns out to be a really great application to use for organizing those plans. I found it very convenient because you can go in web clippings. I hate to keep coming back to that feature, but it is a killer feature, at least for me. Going into Safari, I'm doing my research on the places I might want to visit. I can quickly clip things out. I can drop in photos and images of spots and locations that I might want to go to. Also, when I'm making my reservations, putting all those confirmation numbers, all those important bits of information that you need to have all in one place, drop those right in a notebook. And if you're a more organized person, I don't do this, but you certainly could make checkmarked lists for all kinds of things that you need to do. So if you have stuff you need to make sure that you pack, you could build out your list. You can put all of that in one single notebook. Just call it My Vacation Trip or My Summer Vacation 2011. Throw it in there and you'll have it all together and ready to go. And if you have Circus Ponies on your iPad, notebook for the iPad, then you could sync all that stuff over there, or you could export out a PDF or even throw it up on a web page. Circus Ponies Notebook has a really cool export to web feature, so you could put it up on MobileMe and access it from anywhere via your internet connection. So lots of great features in there. Like I said, 1,001 uses probably for this application. Go check it out. They have a free trial available over at circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So Apple finally came out this week and responded to questions and concerns that people had been having over the GPS data that it was discovered iPhones were collecting and sending up to Apple. Now, initially, it sounded kind of nefarious depending upon what reports you read, but Apple, in their response, kind of belayed the fears or attempted to belay people's fears by saying the data that they were collecting was actually anonymous data. It was aggregate data, not specific to the GPS locations of specific users. And they explained the reason they were collecting that data was supposedly, or at least in part, to build up a location database that they are potentially going to use for a future traffic service. Interesting thing about that is Apple typically doesn't talk about upcoming or future enhancements to their products, but there you have it. It sounds like they're working on some sort of location-based services surrounding traffic. Could that be like turn-by-turn directions, something like that? Potentially. But we really won't know until Apple shows us something in a future release of iOS. And I would imagine they're always kind of working on different features and services, but they're definitely interested in building out this database. So what was happening was they were actually collecting data from Wi-Fi hotspot points and cell tower locations, which seems to be confirmed by the images and the data that we were seeing people post from that application. Because if you notice, it's sort of like a grid. It's not real specific geolocation to specific users. I took a look at mine, and while you can kind of deduce the places someone's been over time, it wasn't really specific. So I think that kind of jibes with what Apple was telling us. Now, there were some other concerns about that data because it was being collected, as people discovered, even when you turned location services off on your phone. Apple came out and said, well, that was actually a bug. It shouldn't have been sending that data up to Apple. And they also said there was another bug with the history or the amount of information that appeared to be cached on the phone. And actually, turns out, Apple says it wasn't really a caching. What it actually was after they aggregated this data, so they collected it and aggregated it into their database, the phone would then pull down a 2 megabyte chunk of data, cached data that was stored on the phone to be used for the location services on the device so that it could quickly go out and find your location. Turned out with a 2 megabyte file size, that was a lot of data, up to a year's worth of aggregate or collected data that could be pulled back down to the device. Apple says they're going to change that in a future update, switch it to a 7-day cache. And then the other thing that was happening was that file was being backed up when you ran your iPhone backup from the device to iTunes. They're no longer going to do that either. They said there's no reason to be backing up that data because it's mainly used on the device for this location cache. So they're not going to back it up. They also will honor location services being turned off and not send any of the data even into the aggregate database, and they will delete any file that's already on your phone. That just means, though, when you turn location services back on, it's going to have to pull down another cache of that data. And also, as you're going to hear in a second, might affect your ability to get your location on your phone quickly, or it's going to actually probably slow down that process. Apple also, another one of the concerns was that the data was not encrypted on your device. Apple's going to encrypt that data in future updates. Now, why Apple was caching the data is actually, again, makes a lot of sense. So it's too bad it took Apple so long to actually respond to these issues, because I think it made it look like they were trying to spin it or something like that. But I think what they were really doing is what they typically do when these situations happen is they have to go in and deduce and kind of figure out what's going on. Steve Jobs in some statements kind of alluded to this fact that, you know, they're technical, they're a technical company, and they build hardware and software services to try and benefit their customers. And they may not always think about, you know, specific types of these issues. And when they hear about an issue, they want to be able to go in, they want to figure out what's going on and why certain decisions were made before they respond to them. Luckily, this time around, I think they responded a little bit more quickly than they did, say, with the AntennaGate issue last year. So that was kind of nice to see. But in terms of why they were caching the data, on your device, to get an actual GPS signal can take up to about 12 minutes to acquire the actual data. With this assisted data, this information being on the phone, it can sort of quickly deduce a relative location to where you are, not very specific, and then slowly hone in. That's how we see this. You know, when you bring up location services, you kind of get a big dot, and it sort of gets more and more clarity over time as the other stuff kicks in. That's this assisted GPS stuff. So Phil Schiller kind of tried to put things in perspective in a response. They did an interview, I believe, with the Wall Street Journal, where they responded to some questions, some of the executives. And he said, you know, this is kind of like the same kind of data that gets tracked when you go into a retail store, you walk into a retail store and make a purchase. And even admitted that Apple does this kind of tracking in their retail stores. And it's been going on for years, and no one's made a really big deal about it because it's anonymous. Now, I don't know if it's in the case of the retail stores, but in the case of the data collecting that Apple's collecting, it's anonymous, and it's not being used to track individual users. And I think that was proven also. If you looked at the data, if you ran the iPhone tracker application and actually looked at the data, you could see that it was actually a grid. And it almost looks like you could draw lines between it, and you have a really nice patterned grid because it's these cell tower locations and these Wi-Fi hotspot locations. Problem is that you could get a relative area of where a person traveled over time, and I think that's where a lot of people's concerns were. And certainly isn't over. Apple and Google have been asked to testify at some federal privacy hearings. Apple said they would respond and send at least a representative. It's going to be interesting to see who goes. I don't think it's going to be Steve Jobs himself, but there's going to be some Senate hearings, and Apple will be there to respond to questions from the government. You know, and as far as the fixes go, I think I actually would want my iOS device reporting my location, because I wonder about services like Find My iPhone, which a lot of people have been able to use that to recover lost devices, to get back stolen devices. If you actually turn location services off and your device is no longer reporting its location, I'm not sure how Apple would make a service like that work, unless there's some other way to opt into that information. I think now it happens through the push services from MobileMe, because you do have to have those on to get it to work. And I think when the push data comes down, the device also pings back its location. So maybe that can operate separately. I don't know. But I wouldn't want to opt out of my location services and have that important feature not work. So I think Apple's going to turn to a more opt-in and more open, transparent solution. But I think at the end of the day, most of us are going to want to opt in, because the benefits are going to outweigh any risks, especially if the data is maintained to be anonymous. And the whole thing is a little bit, I think I mentioned this on the last MacCast, if you actually go in and read the terms of service for your iPhone, it does say that Apple is collecting this kind of information and sending it out there. So it wasn't totally transparent and upfront that Apple was doing it, but it certainly was there in the writing. So I think legally they're covered. There's been, of course, some lawsuits that have popped up, and we're going to be hearing more about those in the future. But I think for now, location gate is probably over. It's probably put pretty much to rest. And I think at the end of the day, we're going to be a little bit better off because tech companies and smartphone companies are going to have to take a little bit more responsibility and be a little bit more transparent about what they're doing with this data and when and how they're collecting it. We know that Apple's been struggling to meet iPad 2 demand. As a matter of fact, they've been bringing on some new suppliers. We've heard rumors of some new display suppliers coming on board. Apple this week just launched in 11 new countries, so demand is getting even stronger. And we know that one of the ways that Apple is able to meet that demand, and in their last quarter of the conference call, they were pretty confident that in the third quarter, they were going to be able to get supplies up and meet demands. We know one of the ways that they do that is through investing money, sort of pre-purchasing components and making commitments to suppliers. Well, in Apple's 10Q filing, it looks like that's exactly what they're doing again. Their spending is going to be up from the $7.9 billion they spent in the December quarter. Apple's bringing it up to about $11 billion. Analysts believe that at least a portion of that is going to be used for long-term commitments, which are going to help Apple maintain better supplies and have the added benefit of kind of locking out some of their competitors. We've seen that with the displays. There's lots of rumors that because Apple's locked up so many of the touch panels that some of their competitors in the tablet space are having a hard time getting to market as quickly as they'd like to. I think a similar thing happened with the flash RAM supplies. Apple has locked up so much flash memory for such a long time that I think that's actually why, and this is my own theory, why some of the competitors' tablets don't have 64 gigabyte models. We've really only seen 32 gig models. And I know that they probably could combine some chips and get 64 gig models in the market, but I think they don't want to do that at the risk of constraining their own 16 gigabyte and 32 gigabyte models supplies. So Apple has a history of doing this. In the 10Q, it seems like they've at least allocated another $2 billion for long-term commitments. We know back in January, Apple made a commitment to some supplier for about $3.9 billion in strategic investments for components. So Apple definitely laying the groundwork to continue to have a good supply chain for now and I guess into the near future. Apple released a number of updates this week, software updates, including a pretty major one for Snow Leopard, especially if you're a graphic designer or anybody who works with OpenType fonts. macOS 10.6.7 Snow Leopard font update was released. It addressed an issue with displaying and printing of OpenType fonts, also addressed an issue in which some OpenType fonts would not display correctly in certain applications, resolved issues with printing from preview, addressed an issue with PDF files not opening in third-party PDF viewer applications, and resolved invalid font errors when printing to PostScript printers. So if you've been suffering from any or all of those issues, probably want to run your software update or grab the update through Apple's support site at apple.com/support. In addition, they released an iPhoto update, iPhoto 9.1.2 for iPhoto 11, addressed an issue that prevented the zoom slider from being accessible in magnification one-up view. Also addressed an issue where toolbars were not auto-hiding in full screen mode. The search field now correctly performs and includes search when searching on a text string. They fixed some minor formatting issues with books, cards, and calendar themes. Message size of emails now correctly updates and changes when you make changes to the photo size menu. Addresses an issue that prevented some iPhoto 5 libraries from upgrading correctly. Multiple book pages can now be drag selected when in all pages view, and the design tools in print project panels are now accessible via separate layout and option buttons. Photo backgrounds applied to a book are now preserved when the book type is changed, and the tab key can now be used to navigate through all of the text fields in a book project. So a lot of updates in that one. Also, Apple reportedly added a couple new card themes. So if you enjoy using the iPhoto cards, and they're actually really great, if you've never had a chance to play around with those, you probably should check them out. There are some new themes to choose from. So iPhoto update can be accessed through your software update tool or through Apple's support website as well. Apple also released the iMac hard drive firmware update. This one's specifically for owners of the new mid-2010 iMac models and fixes a hard drive issue that may have prevented some iMacs, the 21.5-inch and the 27-inch models, from booting properly. That would be a really annoying one. If you suffered from that, you definitely want to grab the firmware update. And again, that's available through the software update or via Apple's support site. So all those updates in there. And speaking of those iMac models, it looks like they are due for a refresh. I think the mid-2010 models came out in July of last year, sounding like we might see some new models landing on Tuesday, May 3rd. This is according to the rumor websites. They will get some significant updates, although nothing major, but nice little bump to the processors, getting the new Sandy Bridge Core i5 and i7 processors, and also adding in Apple's new Thunderbolt port, which I think is going to be one that we're going to see in every model moving forward. No doubt about that. Apple's really putting its weight behind Thunderbolt, and I think it's going to be a really cool technology. It seems like the peripheral manufacturers are coming on board pretty quickly as well, so I would imagine we'll have a healthy supply of Thunderbolt devices come the end of the summer. It's going to be interesting to see if anybody beyond Apple picks up Thunderbolt, because it is a licensed technology. Intel has said they're going to support both Thunderbolt and USB 3, so there's going to be a little competition going on. I haven't seen a whole lot of positive stuff surrounding USB 3, and it seems like there's getting a lot of buzz around Thunderbolt, but that may just be the circles that I run in being an Apple fan. But it just seems like USB 3 hasn't taken off quite as quickly as USB 2 did. And if you remember, USB 2 was pushed pretty hard by Apple, so they've seem to have put their money and their mouths behind Thunderbolt in terms of the next generation technology for devices, and it's going to be a fun race to watch. If those new iMacs do drop on May 3rd, it's sounding like they're going to be available in Apple retail stores on launch day. The report said that Apple retail store employees have been advised to prepare for what's called a visual night. I guess that's an internal saying that's telling the employees that they can expect to stay late and do a switchover of all the displays and signage and get those new iMac models out on the show floor so that when they open up, people coming into the store can see them, play around with them, and buy them day one. So expect new iMacs on day of release, and that could be Tuesday. If you've been thinking about buying a new iMac, you probably want to wait until then and see what happens. I'm sure you know that Apple has been rumored to be working on some sort of cloud services. They're definitely up to something. They're building a giant data center. Have you heard this? Giant data center in North Carolina, this massive, massive thing. Everybody's wondering what they're going to do with it. Apple has already confirmed that it's something related to iTunes and Mobile Me services, so many are expecting both those services to expand to iTunes, potentially with some sort of music storage locker, but probably something very much beyond that, something to encompass videos and photos and all your files, potential new services within Mobile Me. And there's been a lot of speculation and hype around what Apple's been up to. Now, something that came out this week, and I think it's going to come as no surprise to a lot of us, that the potential name for that new service, iCloud. And the reason many people are thinking it's iCloud is because Apple's rumored to have purchased the iCloud.com domain for $4.5 million. This is according to a report that came out on GigaOM. It was originally owned by a Sweden-based desktop-as-a-service company, and they recently changed the name of their service, rebranded their service to CloudMe, which is actually lending some credence to the story, at least that Apple bought the domain. The price tag is still up in the air on whether or not they really spent that much on the domain. But it also did come out this week that there are reportedly some internal beta builds of iOS 5 and OS X Lion that are already using the iCloud branding and the iCloud name. And that really just makes sense, I would say. I mean, Apple's put a lot of effort behind sort of branding the whole everything as their brand. And if they are going to do a cloud service, it seems like it really would be a front runner. But Whether it ends up being the final name, remains to be seen. We're going to have to wait till Apple actually releases that. Another thing that's kind of unclear is whether or not Apple is going to charge for the services or if they're going to have the services be free. I actually think it's going to be some sort of hybrid. I think Apple's going to make some of the basic features free. I think they're going to actually open up some of the, or I'm hoping that they'll open up some of the current MobileMe features that you pay for, things like syncing of calendar and contacts and stuff like that, bookmarks. I hope they make those services free and then add some add-on services, say like the iTunes storage locker or access to streaming content that might be charged for, or you might pay a subscription fee for. But no one really knows at this point. Apple's not telling us. Can you believe that? Anyway, the service should be shown off at WWDC, at least according to some reports, with probably a release scheduled for the fall, along with new iPhones and iOS devices, which would likely hook into some of the new advanced services, specifically the iTunes-based cloud services. And I follow that logic because that's also generally when Apple's going to announce new iPods, which could, in theory, also take advantage of any kind of cloud storage service that might be available for iTunes content, especially on the iPod Touch. And the other thing is if they announce it at WWDC and show it off to the developers, that gives them some time to develop and integrate services, which could be great if they've planned some sort of online storage for accessing files or additional data that might feed into iOS apps. And I think this is very likely to be part of the whole iCloud initiative. So I think for now we can just call it iCloud and expect to hear more about it in the coming months with a release ending up maybe in the fall. Well, here's an interesting turn of fates. Apple is now more profitable than Microsoft. Just going to let that sink in for a second because it took me a while to wrap my head around that. It's something we typically don't think about or think is going to happen, but Apple posted its profits for its second quarter just a few weeks ago. They came in at $5.99 billion, while Microsoft just reported its net profit from its latest quarter, and it came in at $5.23 billion, so just under Apple. Really close, just within a few points of a billion, right? TechCrunch actually has an interesting timeline of this progression. In May 2010, Apple's market cap actually surpassed Microsoft's, making Apple the most valuable tech company in the U.S. And then in October 2010, Apple beat Microsoft's quarterly revenue numbers. And then January 2011, Apple became the second most valuable U.S. company behind Exxon, again, based on its market cap. And then finally, 2011, Apple beats Microsoft in net quarterly income. So Apple's been on a steady rise. Their stock price has definitely shown it. And their profit margins are apparently showing it as well. So good news for us Apple fans. If you just looked out your window right now and you thought you saw a pig fly, that may have been real because Apple actually shipped white iPhones this week. They went on sale on Thursday. Apple, just about 10 months late, got the white iPhone to market. There was a little bit of demand. In the U.S., I don't think it was as high as the launch of the original iPhone. There were reports of some lines in certain locations, 5-6 people deep. not huge lines, but in China, people went crazy. They sold out in China within hours. Also, ship times in Europe were quickly extended to 5 days. Current checks on the U.S. online store show ship times for the white iPhone between 3 to 5 days, while the black iPhone remains at about 24 hours. As far as what's different beyond the color, there are a couple of little changes you might notice. The proximity sensor is now a slot instead of a little kind of grid that we saw in the original designs. If you take a look at the pictures, the proximity sensor slot sits right above the earpiece slot. It's pretty noticeable, actually, in the design, but I think it was a compensation that Apple had to make to get the sensor performance up where they liked it to be. Also, a couple of sites noted that the iPhone is actually just a hair thicker than the black one, just 0.2 millimeters, but that turns out to be enough that for some cases, specifically hard shell slider cases, that might be a little bit of an issue. So if you are planning on getting a white iPhone and you had a black iPhone 4, you might have some troubles with your cases. Some of the case designers are probably going to have to do a little bit of redesign or actually just open up the tolerances a little bit to get their cases to work with the new white iPhone. As far as why the delay was so long, well, there's been a lot of rampant speculation about that, but it sounds like the reason for the delay was a color issue along with that sensor. Steve Jobs told D All Things Digital, quote, "It's not as simple as making something white. There's a lot more that goes into both the material science of it, how it holds up over time, but also how it all works with the sensors." So he notes that the materials and the sensors were an issue. Apple reportedly added a UV coating to avoid discoloration over time, which means they may have found that the white plastic sort of yellowed, which is typically what does happen with some white plastics, something that they had an issue with actually in other products. If you remember the issues they had with the white MacBooks when they originally released, in that case, I think it was a situation where skin oils were reacting with the plastics and causing premature discoloration. So Apple's had a lot of experience dealing with white materials and getting those to work properly. And it sounds like they did the right thing this time. Rather than rushing something to market and having customers return devices a year, 2, 3 years later, they dealt with the issue up front, discovered the problem, and have hopefully corrected it and enough, at least to their satisfaction, that they're willing to release the device. So if you've been waiting on a white iPhone, now's the time to get it. And you can order it through Apple's online store or pick it up at a local retail store. And then finally in the news, it looks like OS X Lion is one step closer to being released. We expect to see a lot about Lion at the upcoming Worldwide Developers Conference, which is happening in June, and hopefully there will get a release date. Summer is really likely, but it could be the fall. I'm hoping Apple doesn't delay it till the fall, because it's sounding like Lion's almost ready to go. Apple seeded a third beta build to developers, a third beta of Lion Developer Preview 2. In the release notes, there was nothing noted, and only minor UI tweaks are being reported by developers. So usually when Apple doesn't have a lot of bug fixes or things that developers need to be looking into, that means it's getting pretty close to launch. As far as what they changed in the user interface, I guess they made a change to the tab buttons that you would see in different areas, specifically the preference panes. They now have a darker, more sunken look and function more like the traditional tabs. I guess in the prior build, Apple had made a change to sort of a slider version. If you can imagine the slide to unlock thing as being the highlighter, the location for what tab is selected, it would sort of slide along a channel. And wherever that slider was the highlighted section. The problem there was that if you had just two sections, it looked like the non-selected section was actually what was selected, because it was more traditionally matching what you see on OS X today. So they made the change back to that more tab traditional style look, just a little bit darker. Also, there were signs found of a potential Find My Mac feature. This is according to 9to5 Mac. There was an icon and something called the Find My Mac Messenger, along with a Find My Mac framework. So it makes sense that Apple would use location services in Lion to sort of add that functionality, like Find My iPhone or Find My iPad, which has been valuable to a lot of users. I've known many people have been able to recover their devices through those features. So that'll be something nice to have on your laptop, your MacBook Air, something like that. And if Apple rolls that in as a new service, that would be great. macOS Rumors is also reporting a feature called Reading List that seems to have made its way into Safari in the latest build of Lion. This is looking like a way for you to quickly add links to a list for viewing later. It's not active in the current build, but there are references to it, and it seems like a feature similar to Instapaper or Read It Later, although at this point it's kind of speculation because no one really knows how it works because it's not turned on. So it could be more like something like Delicious, where you're just storing bookmarks that sync across devices into an area, sort of temporary bookmarks, I would imagine, that you can come back and review and then pull those websites up later. So who knows if it's going to be offline viewing, if it's going to be more like readability, where it'll give you a text-only view that's stored for offline reading. And no one really knows if it's going to have a syncing component, but I think it almost has to at this point, some way to sync between devices via MobileMe, maybe through the new iCloud services, and that way you can keep your iOS devices in sync with other Macs and also sync across Macs all of that content. And that could be a powerful new feature, but I'm not so sure it would actually displace some of the other services that are already out there, like Instapaper. I think that's pretty entrenched with a lot of users, and has a lot of functionality that's integrated with a lot of very popular iOS apps that I think Apple would have a hard time catching up with. But as a feature for new users, something that's built into the operating system, it could be quite nice. And we should find out pretty soon what the exact features of OS X Lion are, because WWDC is right around the corner and everybody's expecting a good preview, good look at what's in OS X Lion. So we have that to look forward to. On the last episode of the MacCast, I gave you some tips on iWeb. We actually had a question about using iWeb for a small business website, and I gave you some ideas and some thoughts on that. And then I received this comment from Tim, who actually is combining Dropbox along with iWeb in a what I think is a pretty creative way.
Hey, Adam, it's Tim Murray. Listening to the MacCast about iWeb. And I just recently changed the way I was publishing my sites from MobileMe. I now publish them out to the public folder in my Dropbox. And then there's a file created called index.html for each website. I right-click on it, create a public link or copy the public link, and then that's what I give to people to get to the website. And it seems to be working just fine. So I'll let you know.
Hey, Tim, that's really cool. Tip, something I had not thought about using my Dropbox for. I use Dropbox for a lot of things, file sharing mostly, which I think was its main intended purpose, but you do have that public folder, and just by publishing your iWeb site directly to that public folder, you can make that available to anyone. So, as Tim mentioned, publish it to the Dropbox folder, the public folder, and that's important there because you can't share the other folders. Well, you could share the other folders privately, so I guess if you wanted to have sort of a private website that you set up that was behind a password, that may or may not work. I don't know. We have to play around with that a little bit. But put it in your public folder, right-click on the index.html file that iWeb creates, and then you can send that link to someone. You could even go one step further. I would imagine some people want to use their own domain. So if you have a domain service that provides domain forwarding with masking, that's something actually GoDaddy provides, and I tried this, you could actually use your own URL and then just mask it to that Dropbox folder. You just take that same link that you would post to an email and then use that in the settings for your domain forwarding. About the only trouble I could see with what you're doing with Dropbox is that with the free Dropbox account, there is a daily 10 gigabyte data transfer limit. So if you had a website that was popular, you could have Dropbox shut your account down. If you go over that limit, it's my understanding they look at that as potential abuse and they'll shut it down and you have to respond to them via email. If you have one of the paid for accounts, I think that limit goes up to 250 gigabytes. That's not a ton of data, but depending on what kind of site you're serving up, it may be just enough to get you by, and it's free. Something else that we talked about using Dropbox for with respect to iWeb on a past show, I thought I'd just review, is actually sharing the iWeb sites file between two Macs using Dropbox. This would give you the ability to have two Macs accessing one iWeb file and being able to edit the websites that are on that from two different locations. So the way you set this up is you actually quit iWeb, and then you need to move your domain.sites2 file, which you'll find in your home folder, in the library folder, under application support, under iWeb. That's the file that contains all the information about all of your iWeb websites. So when you launch iWeb, it goes out, it looks at that file, and that has all of the different sites contained within it and all the assets and all the information inside of that. So if you move that one file, put it over on your Dropbox, and then point every Mac's iWeb at that one domain sites file, then you can be sharing them. So once you've moved that file, relaunch iWeb, and you should be prompted whether or not you want to create a new domain file or locate an existing one. Choose to locate the existing one, and then just go out and find the domain sites 2 file on your Dropbox. And then on the other Mac that you want to connect, what you'll have to do is move that domain sites file out of the application support iWeb folder in your home folder. And then when you launch iWeb again, it's going to prompt you, go out and point it at the same iWeb file in your Dropbox folder in your home folder, and you should be good to go. Word of warning, if you're going to set this up, accessing the domain.sites2 file from two Macs using iWeb at the same time very likely will corrupt the file. And if you corrupt that file, you're going to lose access to all of the sites and information that you have in there. So be very careful. I'd make sure you're only using iWeb on one machine at a time. And then remember, when you make updates and changes, Dropbox is going to kick in and it's going to sync those changes up to the cloud. So make sure you look at your Dropbox and what it's doing, in that it's finished pushing all those updates to Dropbox before you go launch iWeb on another Mac and connect to that same domain.sites file. But some cool stuff you can do with Dropbox and iWeb, and thanks, Tim, for that tip. Another question that comes up for me over and over again and more lately seems to be, can I connect a hard drive or a flash drive to my iPad and actually access and transfer files using Apple's Camera Connection Kit? Apple's Camera Connection Kit, I think, is the best accessory that you can get for your iPad. It gives you an SD card reader along with a USB connector, and it's that USB connector that's really key, because you can hook all kinds of things into that, including external keyboards, including audio interfaces, audio connectors, microphones, all kinds of stuff, and it'll actually work. And you can hook in your camera, which is the Camera Connection Kit is designed to do, via USB or that SD card slot, and then the iPhoto application will open up and you can actually transfer photos on into the iPad. Now, you typically can't go the other way. Rick wanted to know, can I hook up a flash drive and actually get access to those files? And the short answer is no, Rick. Unfortunately, you can't do that. But there are some interesting things that you can do if you play around with it a little bit. The camera app will actually see files in a DCIM folder at the root of any FAT32 formatted drive. So knowing that, what you can do is you can take Disk Utility and then format, say, a USB stick or an SD card using the FAT32 format. And then once you've done that, you can create a folder called DCIM at the root of that disk. And then any files, any image files or movie files that you put in there that are supported by iOS will actually, well, specifically iOS and the camera app, will actually be recognized by the camera app, and you can actually import those into your device. So that's reading real specific types of files. Unfortunately, if you throw a PDF in there or a text file or Word doc, something else that an iPad would normally recognize, those aren't picked up by the camera app. They're just completely ignored, so you can't transfer files in there. And as far as I know, there's no third-party apps that can actually read that data from the Camera Connection Kit via those mechanisms. So that's a way to access some data on USB sticks and SD cards. If you have other types of cards, compact flash cards, it's also worth noting that using that USB connector, you could hook up a card reader, like a compact flash card reader, through the USB and do a similar thing, pull your images into the photo app on the iPad. So that's a way to read real specific types of files, image files and movie files from different types of cards. Now, writing is a whole separate issue. Writing to a connected drive really isn't possible without getting some third-party hardware and potentially third-party software. A lot of the solutions to me seem kludgy at best, but I'll tell you about a couple of them. HyperMac, the company that is most famously known for their MacBook and MacBook Pro external batteries, they actually have a product called the HyperDrive, which they have it at various price points. It's $99.95 if you just want the case and you want to provide your own hard drive. They also have some solutions that have hard drives and also LCD interfaces on them. But in essence, what it allows you to do is connect it to your iPad via USB using the Camera Connection Kit, and then creates these on-the-fly 32-gigabyte image folders that your iPad can see in the camera app. Again, it only supports image and movie file formats, but what it allows you to do is offload lots of data and images from your camera onto the hard drive, and then you can connect that hard drive to your iPad through the Camera Connection Kit and just suck in the photos and movies that you want. So it's kind of a way for professional photographers who are working in the field to get large volumes of data off their cameras and then still be able to sync those over to their iPads. One interesting thing about the HyperMac solution, and I don't know how they're doing this, is in the camera app, they actually have folders and subfolders, so you can organize your photos and stuff on the HyperMac device and then just pull in specific images from whole specific folders or specific sections of that drive. That's, I guess, a proprietary technology that is patent pending from that company. But that really doesn't address writing to a device. You still can't write from that device. The best potential right now, it seems like, for a device that'll work with your iPad that you can actually write to and actually read and write documents from is something called the Air Stash. It's a $99 USB SD card adapter that has built-in WebDAV support, basically a built-in WebDAV server, which is really cool. So you put a you put an SD card into it, you hook it into the iPad, I think just for power. I think it also has a rechargeable battery built into it, so you can power it up and have it ready to go. And then when you turn it on, it creates a WebDAV share. And iOS, it turns out, is really pretty good at connecting to WebDAV servers for transfers. The iWork apps on the iPad, Pages, Numbers, and Keynote, all support reading and writing directly from a WebDAV server. So you could read and write directly from the SD card through the WebDAV server that's built into it. GoodReader also supports this functionality. I would actually use GoodReader because GoodReader has then the open-in feature, which you could use as a conduit to other applications on your iOS device. So once you have them in GoodReader, you could transfer them over to the application you want to work with and then transfer them back, assuming that application supports the specific file format that you're working with. I've actually contacted AirStash. Hopefully they'll provide me a review unit and I can give you an idea of how well it works. But at this point, it seems like a really nice solution. The only other solution that I ran across was something called the Zoom Media Plus ZoomIt. It's a proprietary SD card adapter, sells for about $40 on Amazon, and they have their own free iOS app for transferring files to and from an SD card connected through their device. So their thing looks just like Apple's Camera Connection Kit, but I guess it has some proprietary hardware in it that allows you to read and write files from their native app. Their native app also supports the open-in option for getting files from their app to other applications to work with. I read through some of the reviews. Most of the negative reviews were related to a feature where it will allow you to actually stream video or watch video right off the SD card. I guess that functionality is a little bit spotty. I don't have access to one of these devices, but it will let you write, so it might be worth checking out. $40 is not too expensive. If anybody has one of these Zoom Media Plus devices, let us know. Let us know how it's working, and I'd be happy to share that on a future episode of the MacCast. But the bottom line for all of these solutions is they are kind of hackarounds. The Air Stash seems like the most reliable because it uses technologies that Apple has said they support. They support WebDAV. Obviously, it's built into their applications, so that's an open standard that's likely to continue to work. These other solutions, I don't really know if Apple could tweak some things in the software that might shut them down. The only other option I'd recommend to you, Rick, would be to use web-based services like Dropbox or the companion service DropDAV, which actually gives you a WebDAV server through your Dropbox that you can connect to. I know a lot of people that really like that service. For the record, I personally don't use DropDAV because you have to provide your Dropbox username and password to the service. I'm not comfortable doing that, but I know a lot of people who've used the DropDAV service and swear by it. They absolutely love it. So I think it's safe. I'm not saying it's not safe. Just for me personally, I didn't feel comfortable doing that. But there are a couple different solutions and options for you, Rick. Hopefully one of them will work for you. And if anybody has used any of these products and have been happy with them, I guess beyond even the ZoomIt, let us know. Or if you have another solution, maybe there's some other things that I didn't run across. So happy to hear those and share those on a future episode. So we talked a little bit about Thunderbolt coming to the new iMacs pretty soon, and Apple's really put its weight behind Thunderbolt. But another technology that came out before Thunderbolt, been around for a while, there's a number of devices and drives out there for it, is USB 3. And if you want to use USB 3 on your Mac, and this is especially useful if you have an older Mac that maybe isn't going to get a Thunderbolt port and you want to have the latest and greatest fastest speed interface available, the folks over at CalDigit actually have a USB 3.0 drive called the AV drive that works with the Mac. And they sent me along a review unit to play around with. It's actually a dual interface drive, has two FireWire 800 ports and a USB 3.0 port. I received the unit, took it out of the box, and I have to say it has a really nice aluminum housing. It has an ambient temperature controlled fan, which is something you don't see on a lot of drives. Higher end drives tend to have the fans, keeps them cooler, running better, and has all of the software and hardware to support USB 3 on the Mac. Apple doesn't officially support USB 3 on the Mac, but what CalDigit has done is they developed their own drivers that's included on the drive. When you plug it in, you actually have an installer and a wizard for setting it up, and they also provide the connections via either Express 34 card slot or a PCI card if you have a Mac Pro. So I happen to have a 15-inch MacBook Pro, so they sent me the version that has the Express 34 card slot option. Install the drivers, and away you go. They also include some additional software on there, including Carbon Copy Cloner, which I like to see, along with RAID tools and a couple other utilities. Now, I did have one hiccup when I received the drive. My Express 34 card was dead on arrival. It did not work, but they quickly sent me a new unit, and the replacement did fix the issue. So once I got it up and running, the first thing I wanted to do was run some speed tests and really see how fast the USB 3 performed. I decided to try a couple different methods, one just copying files to and from different drives and doing comparisons, so some what I would consider real-world tests, and then also just using some of the benchmarking tools. I used the AJA system test tools, which are available online. And with those, you basically transfer a file of a certain size. I did a 1 gigabyte file back and forth on different drives to kind of do a comparison. So I started out just testing my internal MacBook Pro drive. That's a 5400 RPM drive, and it came out as expected fairly slow, about 19.5 megabytes per second on the read and 16.0 megabytes per second on the write. Then I escalated up to a FireWire 400 drive. I have a Seagate Free Agent Pro that's running at 7200 RPM. In that case, I got about a 30 megabyte per second write time and a 32 megabyte per second read time. Then I wanted to jump up to something that the CalDigit could be compared against. That's FireWire 800. I used my OWC Elite AL Mercury Pro drive. Now, that's a 2.5-inch drive, so it's running at 5,400 RPMs. But it got a really pretty decent write time of 57.7 megabytes per second and a read time of 68.8 megabytes per second. Now, CalDigit claims that their drive has about 30% better FireWire 800 performance than other FireWire 800 drives, and that was kind of confirmed by my tests, because when I hooked up the CalDigit AV drive on FireWire 800, it did get a write time of 58.5 seconds, so not a lot faster on the write, but the read was 71.9 megabytes per second, so did get a better read time. And that did translate to just about 30% faster. Now, the CalDigit drive is a 7200 RPM drive versus my 5400 RPM drive, so I don't know how that factored into the comparison. And lastly, jumped over to the USB 3.0, and the CalDigit AV drive did not disappoint in performance there. 105 megabytes per second on the write time, and 123 megabytes per second on the read. Now, CalDigit, I think, says it'll go up to 160 megabytes per second on the USB 3. I didn't get nearly that high a number on my tests, but certainly no slouch in terms of the data transfer performance. Then I moved on to my real-world tests, and in this case, I had a 6.75 gigabyte movie file that I moved back and forth. Transferring it from the CalDigit drive back to my Mac took about 6 minutes, 25.2 seconds, and then going from my Mac to the CalDigit AV drive took about 8 minutes and 27.5 seconds. So for comparison, I thought I'll do the same file to my Mercury Elite Pro, a 5400 RPM USB 2 drive, and the numbers came out very close on the transfer from my drive to my Mac using USB 2, 6 minutes and 50 seconds versus the 6 minutes and 25 seconds that I got for the CalDigit USB 3 drive. And then going from my Mac to the external USB 2 drive, it actually turned out to be faster, 7 minutes and 3 seconds versus the 8 minutes and 27 seconds going to the CalDigit drive. So I was kind of shaking my head and wondering, why am I seeing numbers like that? And then I realized what the rub of all of this is, and that is, and this is going to be true for any drive, this is not just related to the CalDigit drive, the speed is determined by the slowest player. So in my case, that's that 5,400 RPM internal drive that got those really low numbers in the AJA tests, the low read-write speeds. So in all of these real-world tests, I'm reading and writing from my internal drive, and that's likely slowing down all of the numbers, regardless of the device that's on the other end, be it the CalDigit on USB 3 or my OWC drive on USB 2. So numbers, you know, are coming out exactly the same. And you have to remember the theoretical maximums on all these devices. So depending on what you're reading from and what you're writing to, you're going to be throttled down. So USB 2.0 maxes out at 480 megabits per second. eSATA, 1.5 gigabits to 3 gigabits per second. And most of Apple's internal SATA drives are hooked up on that kind of connector. So you're going to be throttled at 1.5 gigabits or 3 gigabits per second, even if you hook up a USB 3 drive like the CalDigit drive that has a theoretical maximum transfer rate of up to 5 gigabits per second. Thunderbolt is going to have 10 gigabits per second, and that's bidirectional. So in theory, you'll be able to write 10 gigabits and read 10 gigabits per second at the same time. But again, if you're not going to another Thunderbolt drive, if you're going to something slower like your internal drive that's on a 1.5 gigabit per second connection, then that's what you're going to be throttled down to. So application becomes really important when you're thinking about these drives and wondering what you're going to use it for. So if you're going directly to the CalDigit drive, you can expect absolutely the best throughput. And in my test, that turned out to be really great. So if you have two CalDigit drives and you're moving data back and forth between both of them, awesome. If you are using a video application and you're reading and writing data directly through that USB 3 connection to the CalDigit drive, it's going to give you really great performance. And as I mentioned at the beginning, if you have an older MacBook Pro or a Mac Pro and you need a fast connector, Thunderbolt is probably not going to be available to you, and the USB 3 option from CalDigit is a very nice solution. It's also, as I mentioned earlier, the only solution for USB 3 on the Mac that I'm aware of. Apple doesn't officially support it natively, and there's kind of no indication at this point that they actually will. CalDigit officially only supports their USB 3 drive, but other devices may work. They're just not going to support them. You're going to have to go in and test them on your own. I didn't actually have any to test, but I'm sure there's information online about what devices might work with their adapter and their drivers. As far as pricing goes, the drives, they have 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, and 3 terabyte versions. You can get them with the PC card, that's a PCI card that goes into your Mac Pro, or the Express 34 card for the notebooks. With the PC card, a 1 terabyte drive is $258 US, $358 for the 2 terabyte drive, and $448 for the 3 terabyte. If you get the options with a laptop card, they're $10 more expensive, $268 for the 1 terabyte, $368 for the 2 terabyte, and $458 for the 3 terabyte. About $100 more than you would probably pay for a comparably sized FireWire 800 drive, if you're trying to put that in perspective, but you are getting the USB 3, and all of their drives have a 1-year warranty. That's a bit low, in my opinion, for higher-end drives, but these are pretty solidly built. They have the fans in there that should keep cooling down, so that should keep drive reliability up. I wouldn't expect that you'd have a problem. I think they do offer some extended warranty options if you're really concerned about it, but it does cost a little bit extra. So a little bit of a pricier solution, but if you're looking for the fastest possible throughput on an older Mac, this is a really nice option to have, and I'm glad CalDigit is providing it. But my only other complaint with the drive is that when the fan was getting up to full speed, it is a little bit noisy, so it's a little bit noisier drive, but that is because of the cooling, and because it is a smart sensor, it wasn't always on. So it would only ramp up when I was using the drive really heavily or doing heavy testing with it. Otherwise, it was relatively quiet. That and a little bit pricier than some other drives. But at the end of the day, it seems like a very solidly built drive. It lived up to its speed expectations in terms of the benchmarking tools and testing that I was able to do. So if you're looking for a USB 3 solution for your Mac, certainly check it out. I'll have links to it up in the show notes at maccast.com. One interesting little thing did happen to me during testing that I thought might be useful if anybody else has run into this little bug. During testing, I was moving a lot of files around, moving them back and forth between external volumes. And at one point when I tried to copy or delete a file from one of my external volumes, I got this strange -1407 error, a little ambiguous error from the Finder. And in essence, it wouldn't let me move those files or delete them from that drive. It was pretty much inaccessible at that point. And so I poked around. I was worried that maybe the drive was broken. I had done something to it and it wasn't going to be able to be recovered from. But it turned out it was a pretty easy fix. All I had to do was run disk utility and run verify on the drive. And once I did that, it found no errors. But when it came back, when it was done doing the verification, I could use the drive again. I could delete files off of it. I think what really happened was using disk utility to do the verify forces the drive to unmount and then remount. I think in that process, it kind of rejiggered things and got me access back to the drive. So I probably could have accomplished the same thing by simply ejecting the drive and reconnecting it or just rebooting my Mac, and it probably would have fixed things up. But if you run across that -1407 error with your external drives, you might try a couple of those things. In doing the prep for my show, of course, one thing I do is run through a lot of RSS feeds, a lot of news articles. So I'm reading a lot of commentary and comments, hear a lot from analysts and people like that comparing Apple to other companies, looking at stats and numbers. And we try and use these numbers and stats and information to kind of gauge how well Apple is doing or how successful they will be or were or are currently. And there's also a fair amount of comparison that goes on when you're doing that. You're comparing Apple to other companies, trying to figure out who's bigger, who's got more market share, who's this, that, and the other. And more recently, lately, we've been comparing Apple a lot to Google and to Android. Everybody wants to see a competitor rise up for Apple's iOS and their tablet devices, and Google seems to be the front runner for that. And a good example of this sort of back and forth and these numbers coming out are some of the latest numbers from Nielsen and ComScore. Nielsen came out with U.S. smartphone share numbers, and they're pretty bullish on Android, saying that Android has the largest market share in the smartphone market in the U.S., 37% for Android, 27% for iOS. They're quick to point out that Android is growing rapidly, while iOS is sort of stalemated or not growing as quickly as it was in the past. BlackBerry, with their numbers, accounts for about 22% of the U.S. smartphone market. And then ComScore came along, and they recently looked at the numbers for all mobile phones and connected devices, which would include tablets and iPods, and they found contrary numbers. iOS had about 16.2% share when you looked at all devices, Android just 10.2%. And they went beyond that, looking at iPad ownership among different smartphone groups, and they found that about 10% of iOS users use iOS on more than one device. So there's not as much fanboy crossover. This is sort of how the terms they put it in, showing that basically, it's not just fanboys that are buying iOS devices or buying iPads specifically. They found that 27% of iPhone owners owned an iPad, while 17% of BlackBerry owners actually had an iPad, and then 14% of Samsung phone owners and 12% of LG phone owners. So it's not just Apple fans that are buying the iPad. Other groups are buying iPads. And so we have all these numbers. Then, you know, as far as something else we've been hearing about a lot lately is App Store numbers and how many apps and how many developers are developing for a platform. And that's sort of supposed to gauge how healthy the platform is or what the growth is. Latest numbers came from an App Store analytics company called Destimo, and they concluded that Android apps are growing very, very quickly. And they predict that Android will have as many apps as iOS around the middle of this year, sometime this summer. I found it a little bit odd because currently, the last numbers we heard for iOS apps were there were about 350,000. I think that was back in January. And the current count on Android apps puts it around 150,000. That's according to Google. Android is definitely growing much faster in the app market than iOS. iOS has slowed down a bit, but iOS has been around longer. You reach 350,000 applications, there's not a ton more applications that you can put out there. Well, maybe there is, but you would expect it to kind of slow down. And Android's still growing. A lot of the apps that we see on the iOS store are just starting to show up on Android, and that growth, you would expect them to be, I guess, the same over time. The other thing that's happening is Apple's more restrictive in terms of what apps they let in. Android's a free and open market, so anybody can throw anything up there, be it shovelware or what have you. Another interesting stat is that about 63% of Android apps are free versus about a third of the iOS apps tend to be free. And the CEO at Evernote even kind of commented on the fact that iOS customers seem to be more likely to buy applications, and therefore developers are probably best served by developing for iOS first and then moving into the other platforms later if they want to sort of maximize their profits and the money that they can get from their devices. The reason I'm bringing all this up is I just find it funny that with all of our analysis and all the things that we do to kind of compare, contrast, and we lob bombs, you know, over at Android and they lob stats and figures back at us, I get the distinct feeling that at the end of the day, for a lot of the people at Apple and Steve Jobs included, they really just don't care much about all this. They really don't care about the market share and what's happening here. And it's not to say they don't care about success or they don't care about profit margins or they don't care about what's happening in trends and stuff like that. Apple wants to grow. They want to get bigger. They want to make more money. I think any company that doesn't want to do that is just, I would look at it and say, is crazy. I mean, that's the whole point of all of this. But I think more importantly, what Apple's goal is to just make great products that people want to use. And that's something I admire about the company, is that I think the driving experience behind Apple has always been the technology and the innovation. And I think they really feel and they believe that if they do that, then the profits, and it's become obvious now that this is true, that the profits will follow, that they will have success despite things like market share. I'll point to some technologies like copy and paste on iOS. It would have been very easy for them to just throw that out there and have it. And they actually took a lot of flack and took some hits in the press and the media for not having copy paste on iOS when it was launched. But I think they really felt they needed to get that experience right, and that experience decision won over a technical one. And I think ultimately we ended up with something that's really great. And a lot of people have since copied on their devices in terms of how that functionality works. The white iPhone is another great example. Apple could have put that white iPhone out there, not told anybody of the discoloration issue they knew about, and dealt with it 2 years down the road. And they would have sold a lot of white iPhones out the gate. They might not sell as many now because people opted to buy the black one and not wait for the white one. But that was a decision made on experience. They want customers to have a phone that they're happy with. And so they waited, maybe took a little bit of a hit, but I think in the long run, they come out ahead. And it's always seemed to me that Steve Jobs' goal is to look back and sort of say, you know, and these are obviously my words, not his, but, you know, that we made really cool stuff that people love to use, and that he had a lasting impact on the world, that the stuff he put out there was worthwhile and sort of changed things. And I think they look at that as a bigger measure of how much Apple is worth than just market share and bottom line numbers. And I think at the end of the day, if we look at Apple's current stock price, if we look at the numbers they posted at their second quarterly results call, I think it's all working for Apple, and I think it always has. You know, we had some rough years, but I think that was when the vision wasn't there. Really, this idea that making really great products that impact the world, really making really great technology that people love to use, I think that's a core competency and something at the root of Apple, and it's nice to see that back in there, and I think it still really is a driving force. So I think as analysts and other people look at Apple, they tend to forget that stuff. Us, you know, call us fanboys if you'd like, but that's how we like to think about Apple, and it might be drinking the Kool-Aid, but the Kool-Aid tastes pretty good. And I think it's one thing that competitors just, they don't get, and it's an edge that Apple has because they're looking at features and they're looking at technology and they really think it's the technology. But at the end of the day, it goes beyond the technology. It's something that transcends the technology to a certain degree. And again, I'm going to take flack because for sounding spiritual or crazy, but I think we get it. I think Apple gets it. And obviously consumers are getting it in a really big way now, and that's something that hasn't happened in the past. It used to be about the fanboys, but now it's becoming about consumers, and consumers are getting it. I think they're ready to get it, and they're kind of fed up with having to deal with technology they don't understand, and they want something that's simple and easy to use, and that's what Apple is providing. But it's something that Apple drove internally. They didn't drive it from competition. They didn't drive it by looking at what their competitors were doing and trying to out-feature them. What they did was they looked at, okay, how do we make great products? And then through iterations, they said, how do we make this stuff a bit better? But how do we make it better from the experience standpoint? And they'll let the experience sort of drive the technology and what they put in there. But then they make sure when they do get to the technology part that they use the absolute best technology. And sometimes there's a price premium for that. But I think consumers are saying enough, all right? We know we can get it cheaper. We know we can get it with maybe more features, but we want the great experience, and we want the device that does what we need it to do. It doesn't have to do it the absolute best or fastest, but if it does it the easiest in a way we understand, that's what we like, and that's what we're willing to pay for, and Apple's gaining great success on that. So hopefully Apple's competitors will kind of key into that and help drive more competition, because I think that helps push Apple forward. But Apple's done a pretty good job of just driving themselves internally too, so I'm not sure that it's absolutely necessary. So for all this numbers and analysis and stuff that we like to do and we kind of throw on Apple, I think the summary is I think Apple's going to continue to be Apple, and they're going to continue to do what they do. We'll continue to watch and look at it and try and understand it, but I think at the end of the day, they get it and consumers get it, and that's what's going to win out in the end. And then the last item I have for you today, you know, if you've been listening to the show, you know I am in love with Apple's new AirPlay technology. I think it's one of the coolest technologies to come along in a while. It's been a long time building. I know we kind of had, you know, the Air, what did Apple call it before it was called AirPlay? They called it AirTunes. I always forget what that thing was called. So it was called AirTunes, now called AirPlay. It's expanded into video beyond just the audio, and you can do a lot more with it. You can send audio from your iOS devices to typically an Apple TV 2 or an AirPort Express. You can send it from your Mac to an Apple TV 2 to an AirPort Express or any other kind of AirPlay compatible devices. We're going to see more things like speaker systems and stuff that are coming to market that are AirPlay compatible, so going straight from our devices to those types of systems. And Erica Sadoun over at the Unofficial Apple Weblog, she also does some development on the side. She's been fascinated with the technology also, and she's been putting out some really cool stuff where she's kind of reverse engineered a lot of the processes and figured out and pushed the limits of what AirPlay can do. And she's done a few different projects, but her latest one is something called Banana Tunes. And in essence, what she's done is reverse engineered AirTunes to go back to the Mac. So what happens is Banana Tunes is a beta application. You can download it. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically what it does is it does for audio what her AirPlayer application, which I talked about on a previous MacCast, did for video, allowing you to take video, or in this case audio, from an iOS device and send it back to your Mac and use your Mac as the receiver. Now, in order to use this application, you do need to install the libao dynamic audio library, which is included in the link that I give you. It's an included download from her website. You are going to be loading these files at kind of an underlying system level, so if you're not comfortable with that, you might want to avoid playing around with this. But if you've got a good backup, make sure you have backup before you try this, and you're comfortable doing this sort of thing. All you need to do is grab these files, unzip them. You'll go to I think the easiest way to do it is to go to the Go menu in the Finder and choose Go to Folder. And then the files are going to go in your user local folder. So you'll type /usr/local. And then in there, you should see a lib folder, a library folder. If you don't, you can just create one. You'll be prompted for a password. You do need admin privileges to do this. Once you have the lib folder in there, you'll drop the AO folder and the libao.4 dynamic library into that location. Once you have those in place, then you can grab the application, the Banana Tunes application from Erica's website, and just launch it and run it. It doesn't have any kind of user interface. It's just running there in the background. But once it's launched and running in your dock, what you should see is when you go to your iOS device and play some music, say on the iPad app, and then click on the AirPlay button, you'll see your Mac as a destination or as a set of speakers that you can connect to. And once you hit that, the audio will go from your iPad and start playing right on your Mac. It's pretty cool to actually see it in action, or hear it in action, I guess, in this case. And really, really neat that Erica is developing these types of applications. I'm not sure it's really necessary, because you could just play the audio right on your Mac and iTunes, but still fun to play around with. And if you'd like to do that, I'll have links to the files you need to download. I will mention, I'll also have a link to a package installer that'll do all of this, so you don't have to go in and mess with the user local folder. But it's from a third party, so it's completely untrusted. Use it at your own risk. I'm not saying it's unsafe, but there's just no way of knowing what's in there. But I'll have a link to that if you find that more convenient and you're not worried about it. So a little AirPlay hacking to finish things off today. And if you haven't just played around with AirPlay, you should check it out. Try it out. Mess around with it. See if you like it. I'm kind of giddy over it. I've been using it quite a bit and just am amazed every time I press the button and audio goes from one location to another, or video goes from one location to another. And it just works. It's one of those technologies that is pure Apple, the magical technology that just works as expected. So far, so good, at least for me. All right, that's going to do it for the episode for today. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show's sponsors. Circus Ponies Makers Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information, as well as trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, and Text Expander Touch. You can get Text Expander on your iPhone. It's integrated with a bunch of the iOS apps, probably many of the ones that you're already using. So that's really cool. You can get information and trials of their desktop applications over at smilesoftware.com. And Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. Check out their software, get information and demos over at Furonix.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. If you have any feedback for me, want to comment on something on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Leave a voicemail message there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And be sure to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or join up on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast, and keep in touch between episodes. If you need information, show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those over at maccast.com. New music for you today comes from Music Alley. That's the PodSafe Music Network. I don't know if it's formerly the PodSafe Music Network or what have you, but they have great music over there that I am allowed to play on the podcast. There's great artists over there that make this stuff available. If you like what you hear, please visit their website, check out their stuff, or even better yet, buy the track on iTunes. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. Best way to support these artists who allow me to play their music. And that's a big deal, because otherwise I'd have to pay big licensing fees and wouldn't be able to share this great stuff with you. So today's track is called Love and Tragedy by Valari. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time.
I was a love and tragedy. Every day was just another catastrophe. I felt like I was going sick and of crazy. I was a bit of gypsum in the stream. The noose was getting tied around my neck. There were only three marbles left. I didn't think I'd ever see land again. I've heard things I wish I could forget.